Against Celsus, Book 3. In the first of our books, Against Celsus's boastful title. For he entitled the book he composed against us True Word, as you instructed, most faithful Ambrose, to the best of our ability we went through his preface, and then, taking up each of the things he said in turn, examined them, until we came to the speech he puts in the mouth of the Jew, fabricated as though addressed to Jesus. And in the second book we took up the whole of it. As best we could, we answered the points made against us, against those who through Christ believe in God, in the speech of that Jew of his. We now take up this, the third book, in which our task is to contend against what he sets out as though speaking in his own person. He says that Christians and Jews argue with each other most foolishly, and claims that our dialogue with one another about Christ is no different from what the proverb calls a fight over a donkey's shadow. And he supposes there is nothing dignified in the mutual inquiry of Jews and Christians, given that both believe that some Savior was prophesied by a divine spirit as one who would come to dwell among the human race, yet no longer agree about whether the one prophesied has already come or not. For we Christians have believed that Jesus is the one who has come in accordance with what was prophesied, whereas the majority of Jews remain at such a distance from trusting him that those alive at that time went so far as to conspire against Jesus, while those living now, endorsing what the Jews back then presumed to do against him, likewise continue to slander Jesus, claiming he had, through some form of sorcery, invented the notion that he was the one heralded by the prophets as coming to dwell among them. Summoned according to Jewish ancestral custom the Christ. Let Celsus, then, and those who are pleased with what he says against us, tell us whether it resembles a donkey's shadow that the Jewish prophets foretold beforehand the place of birth of the one who would lead those who have lived well and who form the portion belonging to God, and that a virgin would conceive Emmanuel, and that there would be such signs and wonders performed by the one prophesied, and that, with such swiftness his word will run, and that the sound of his apostles would go out into all the earth, and what he would suffer when condemned by the Jews, and how he would rise again. Did the prophets, then, say these things at random, with no plausibility at all moving them not merely to say them, but even to judge them worthy of being written down? And is it likewise the case that so great a nation as the Jews, who long ago took possession of a land of their own to inhabit, proclaimed some as prophets and rejected others as false prophets with no plausibility at all behind it? And was there nothing among them prompting them to number the words of those reckoned to be the later prophets together with the sacred books of Moses, trusted as they were? And can those who charge Jews and Christians with foolishness show us how it was possible for the nation of the Jews to hold together if there had been no promise of foreknowledge among them at all? And that while the surrounding nations each, according to their own ancestral customs, believed they received oracles and divinations from those they reckoned to be gods, these people alone, taught to despise all the so-called gods of the nations as not gods but demons, since their prophets said of them that every god of the nations is but a demon. They had no one who promised to prophesy and who was able to draw away those who, out of desire for foreknowledge of the future, wished to desert to the demons found among the others. Consider, then, whether it is not necessarily the case that a whole nation, taught to despise the gods worshipped by the rest, should have been well supplied with prophets, who from the very outset display something greater and surpass the oracles found everywhere. Then powers were at work everywhere, or in many places, as he himself cites further on, mentioning Asclepius as benefiting people and foretelling the future to whole cities devoted to him, such as Trica, Epidaurus, Cos, and Pergamum, and Aristeas of Proconnesus, and a certain man of Clazomene, and Cleomes of Astypalea. But it is only among the Jews, they claim, that devotion is offered to the God of the universe. Was there no sign or portent that cooperated with and confirmed their faith in the Creator of the universe, together with the hope of living a greater life concerning something else? But how could such a thing be possible? For they would immediately have turned to worshiping the demons who gave oracles and received service, abandoning the God who was believed, only in word, to help them, but who in no way demonstrated his own manifestation. But if this did not happen, if instead they endured countless sufferings rather than renounce Judaism and the law that goes with it, suffering now in Assyria, now in Persia, and now under Antiochus, how is it not established, on reasonable grounds, for those who disbelieve the extraordinary histories and prophecies, that these things were not fabrications, but that some divine spirit, present as it were in the pure souls of the prophets, men who had taken on every labor on behalf of virtue, moved them to prophesy, some things for their own contemporaries and other things for those who came later, and especially concerning someone who would come to dwell among the human race as its savior. But if this is so, why do Jews and Christians dispute with one another about a donkey's shadow, examining, on the basis of the prophecies which they both hold in common, whether the one who was prophesied has come or has not yet come at all but is still awaited? And even if it be granted to Celsus, as a hypothesis, that Jesus is not the one whom the prophets proclaimed, even so the inquiry into the meaning of the prophetic writings is no less something other than a dispute about a donkey's shadow. So that it might be clearly demonstrated what sort of person the one heralded in advance was prophesied to be, and what he would do, and, if possible, also when he would come to dwell among us. Above, we already stated, citing a few prophecies out of many, that Jesus is the Christ who was prophesied. Neither the Jews, then, nor the Christians are mistaken in accepting that the prophets spoke by inspiration from God. Rather, those who are mistaken about the one prophesied and awaited hold false beliefs as to who he is and of what sort he has been proclaimed to be according to the true meaning of the prophets. Next after this, Celsus, supposing that the Jews, being Egyptian by race, abandoned Egypt after rebelling against the Egyptian community and scorning the customary religious practices of Egypt, says that they suffered, at the hands of those who attached themselves to Jesus and believed in him, the very things they themselves had done to the Egyptians, as against Christ, and that for both the cause of the innovation was rebellion against the common order. Now what has Celsus done at this point? It must be examined. The ancient Egyptians treated the race of the Hebrews very badly in many ways, when they had come to sojourn in Egypt, because famine had struck Judea. They then suffered, at the hands of divine providence, as an entire nation acting in concert, what a whole people that had wronged strangers and suppliants ought to suffer, having wronged the whole race of those who had come to sojourn among them, though that race had done them no wrong at all. And when they had been struck by God's scourges, only with difficulty and not long after did they let go, to wherever they wished, those whom they had been enslaving unjustly. Being self-loving, then, and preferring in every way their own kin even over more just strangers, there is no accusation the Egyptians have left unmade that they have not spoken against Moses and the Hebrews, not denying outright the marvelous powers worked through Moses, but claiming that these came about by sorcery and not by divine power. But Moses, since the events show him to have been not a sorcerer, but a pious man devoted to the God of all and partaking of a more divine spirit, both established laws for the Hebrews as the divine voice spoke within him, and recorded the events as they truly happened. Celsus, then, not having become a fair examiner of what is said one way among the Egyptians and another way among the Hebrews, but having been won over beforehand as by a fondness for the Egyptians, agreed with those who wronged the strangers as though they spoke truly, and said that the Hebrews, the ones who were wronged, left Egypt because they were rebelling, not seeing in what way so vast a rebellious multitude of Egyptians, if rebellion were its origin, could have become a nation while at the same time rebelling and also changing its language, so that those who up to then used the Egyptian tongue should suddenly have come to speak fully the Hebrew dialect. But let it be granted, for the sake of argument, that in leaving Egypt they had come to hate even their native language along with it. How then, after this, did they not rather use the dialect of the Syrians, or that of the Phoenicians, but instead formed the Hebrew tongue as something distinct from both? What this argument wants to establish for me is that it is false that people who were Egyptian by race rebelled against the Egyptians and left Egypt and came into Palestine and settled what is now called Judea. For the Hebrews had their own ancestral dialect before their descent into Egypt, and Hebrew letters were different from those of the Egyptians. And it was these that Moses used in writing the five books that are believed among the Jews to be sacred. Likewise, it is false that the Hebrews, being Egyptians, took their origin from rebellion, and that others, being Jews in the time of Jesus, rebelled against the common body of the Jews and followed Jesus. For Celsus, or those who agree with him, will not be able to point to any deed of rebellion on the part of the Christians. And yet, if rebellion had been the cause of the formation of the Christians, who took their origin from the Jews, for whom it was permitted both to take up arms in defense of their own and to kill their enemies, then the lawgiver of the Christians would not have forbidden altogether the killing of a human being, never teaching that it is just for his own disciples to venture violence against a human being, however wicked that person might be, for he did not think it fitting to his own divinely inspired legislation to allow the killing of any person whatsoever. Nor would Christians, if they had begun from insurrection, have accepted laws so gentle that they made it their lot to be killed, like sheep, and never to be able to defend themselves against their persecutors. And yet, examining the matter more deeply, one can say of those who came out of the land of Egypt that the whole people miraculously received all at once, as it were a gift of God, the dialect called Hebrew, all together. As even one of their prophets said, that, when they went out of the land of Egypt, he heard a language which he did not know. And it must further be shown that those who left Egypt in the company of Moses were not Egyptian in stock. Had they been Egyptians, their names ought to have been Egyptian names, since each language yields names akin to itself. But since it is clear from the fact that their names are Hebrew that they were not Egyptians, for the scripture is full of Hebrew names, even of those given by people in Egypt to their sons, it is plain that what is said by the Egyptians is false, that though they were Egyptians, they were driven out with Moses from Egypt. And it is quite evident that, being of Hebrew ancestors according to the history recorded by Moses, they had their own dialect, from which they also gave names to their sons. As for the Christians, since, having been taught not to defend themselves against their enemies, they kept to the gentle and humane legislation, for this very reason, something they would not have accomplished had they taken up the right to wage war, even if they had been very capable of it. They have received this from God, who has always fought on their behalf, and, at the appointed times, has restrained those who set themselves against Christians and wish to destroy them. For as a reminder, so that, seeing a few contending for piety, others might become more approved and despise death. A few, at various times, and very easily numbered, have died for the reverence of God held by Christians, God preventing their whole nation from being utterly worn down. For he willed that it should be established and fill the whole earth with this saving and most pious teaching. And again, so that the weaker might catch their breath from anxiety about death, God took forethought for those who believed, scattering by his will alone every plot against them, so that no king, no local ruler, and no populace could stir up lasting hostility toward them. This much, then, in reply to what was said by Celsus about there having been an insurrection at the beginning, long ago in the case of the founding of the Jews, and later in the case of the Christians coming into being. But since in what follows he plainly lies, come, let us set forth his own words, where he says, if all men wish to be Christians, these would no longer wish it. That this is false is clear from the fact that as far as it depends on themselves, Christians do not neglect to sow the word everywhere in the inhabited world. Some, at any rate, have made it their business to go about not only cities, but also villages and farmsteads, in order to make others too devout toward God. And no one could say that they do this for the sake of wealth, since sometimes they do not even accept what is needed for food, and if ever they do, they would be compelled by this scarcity to be content with mere necessity, even if they wish to share more with others and to give away what was beyond their needs. Now then, perhaps since, because of the multitude of people coming to the word, both wealthy people and some in positions of honor, and women of delicate and noble birth, welcome those who come from the word, someone will venture to say that, on account of the little glory involved, certain people set themselves at the head of the teaching that concerns Christians. Yet it was not reasonable to suspect any such thing at the beginning, when the danger was greatest, above all for those who taught. And even now the disrepute among the rest outweighs the reputed glory among the like-minded, and even that is not shared by all. It is therefore a plain falsehood that, if all people wish to be Christians, these men here would no longer wish to be. But see also what he says is the proof of this, that at the beginning, he says, they were few and of one mind, but once scattered into a multitude, they are again cut apart and split, and each group wants to have its own faction. For this, he says, was what they wanted from the start. That in comparison with the multitude that followed, the Christians were few at the beginning is plain, and yet they were not few in every sense, for the very thing that stirred envy against Jesus and provoked the Jews to their plot against him was the multitude of those who followed him into the deserted places. 4,000 and 5,000 men following him, apart from the number of the women and children. So great, indeed, was a certain drawing power in the words of Jesus, that not only men wished to follow him into the wilderness, but women too, not making an excuse of feminine weakness or of what following the teacher into the wilderness would seem to involve, and quite unaffected children, either following their parents or perhaps also being led by his divinity, so that divinity might be sown in them, followed along with those who had begot them. But let it be granted that they were few at the beginning. What does this contribute toward showing that Christians would not have wished to produce persuasion about the word in all people? He also says that they were all of one mind, not seeing even in this that, from the beginning, there arose disagreements among believers concerning how the books held to be divine were to be understood. Indeed, while the apostles were still preaching, and the eyewitnesses of Jesus were still teaching his teachings, no small inquiry arose among those who believed from the Jews concerning those coming to the word from the nations, whether they must observe the Jewish customs, or whether the burden concerning clean and unclean foods should be lifted as not being incumbent on those who, among the nations, had abandoned their ancestral ways and believed in Jesus. But indeed also in Paul's letters, Paul having lived at the time of those who had seen Jesus, one finds certain statements suggesting that questions had arisen concerning the resurrection and whether it had already occurred, and concerning the day of the Lord, whether it is at hand or not. And moreover, the phrase, avoiding the profane babblings and contradictions of the falsely named knowledge, which some professing, have made shipwreck concerning the faith, shows that from the beginning there arose certain misapprehensions, not yet, as Celsus supposes, of many believers having arisen. Then, since he reproaches us, as if accusing the doctrine, concerning the sects that exist within Christianity, saying, but having been scattered abroad into a multitude, they are again split and cut apart, and each wishes to have its own faction. And he says that, being separated again on account of their numbers, they refute one another, still sharing, so to speak, in one thing, the name, if indeed they still share even that. And this alone they are nevertheless ashamed to abandon, while the rest of their views are arranged differently by different people. To this, we shall reply that heresies have arisen in no subject whose origin is not serious and useful to life. For medicine, being both needful and beneficial to mankind, has much that is disputed within it concerning the manner of treating bodies. For this reason, more numerous sects are admittedly found in medicine among the Greeks, and I think among the barbarians as well, as many of them as profess to practice medicine. Again, since philosophy, professing truth and knowledge of what exists, lays down how one ought to live and attempts to teach what is beneficial to our race, and the matters it inquires into involve much protracted dispute. For this reason, a very great many sects have arisen within philosophy, of which some are more well known and others less so. But even Judaism had, as an occasion for the origin of sects, the differing interpretation of the writings of Moses and the words of the prophets. So then, since Christianity appeared to men to be something venerable, not only, as Celsus supposes, to the more slavish sort, but also to many literary men among the Greeks, sects necessarily arose, not at all on account of factions and love of strife, but because many of the literary men as well were eager to understand the teachings of Christianity, and this followed from it. Since they interpreted differently the divine words believed by all in common, sects arose named after those who admired the origin of the doctrine, but were moved, in whatever way it might be, by certain plausible arguments toward disagreements with one another. But no one would reasonably flee medicine on account of the sects within it, nor would anyone aiming at what is fitting hate philosophy, using its many sects as a pretext for hating it. So too, the holy writings of Moses and the prophets ought not to be condemned on account of the sects that exist among the Jews. But if these things hold together logically, How shall we not likewise offer a defense also concerning the sex among Christians? Concerning which Paul seems to me to have spoken quite admirably. For there must also be factions among you, so that those who are approved may become manifest among you. For just as the one approved in medicine is the one who, through having trained himself amid various schools and having fairly examined most of them, has chosen the one that excels. And just as the one who makes great progress in philosophy does so by coming to know more, having trained himself among the various schools and attached himself to the argument that prevails, so too I would say that the one who has carefully examined the sects of Judaism and of Christianity becomes the wisest Christian. But whoever accuses the doctrine on account of its sects would also have to accuse the teaching of Socrates, from whose school many schools that do not hold the same views. Indeed, one might charge even Plato's doctrines with fault on account of Aristotle, who departed from his school to make innovations, a matter we have also discussed above. Now Celsus, it appears to me, has come to know of certain sects that do not even share with us the name of Jesus. For he had probably heard reports about the so-called Ophians and Chaeans, and if there is any other such school that arose out of a complete falling away from Jesus. None of this, however, has any bearing on making the Christian teaching itself liable to blame. After this, he says, and all the more remarkable is their agreement, the more it would be shown to have arisen from no worthy foundation. But the worthy foundation is their sedition, and the benefit that comes through it, and the fear of outsiders. These are what confirm their faith. To this, too, we shall reply that our agreement arises not in this way from a mere foundation, or rather, not from a foundation at all, but from a divine working, so that its origin is God, teaching human beings through the prophets to hope for the coming of Christ, who would save mankind. For to this extent it is not refuted as untrue, even if it seems to be refuted by unbelievers. To this extent, the message is established as the message of God, and Jesus, being Son of God, is shown to be so both before he became man and after he became man. And I maintain that even after he took on flesh, those whose souls possess the keenest sight still find him ever most fitting to God, truly one descended to us out of God, his origin, and all that follows from that origin, springing not from human understanding, but from the manifestation of God, who by manifold wisdom and manifold powers established first Judaism and after it Christianity. And the supposition that sedition, and the benefit that comes through sedition, is the origin of a teaching has likewise been refuted, a teaching that has converted and improved so many. And that the fear of outsiders is not what sustains our agreement either is clear from the fact that this too was willed by God to have already ceased for a considerable time. And it is likely that the freedom from fear which has arisen in believers with respect to this present life will cease again, once those who in every way slander the teaching come to suppose that the cause of the sedition, now grown so great, lies in the multitude of believers not being warred against by the rulers in the same way as in former times. For we have learned from the teaching neither to grow slack in peace and give ourselves over to relaxation, nor, when warred against by the world, to lose heart and fall away from love toward the God of all in Jesus Christ. We openly declare the dignity of our origin instead of concealing it, contrary to what Celsus supposes, since even for those newly being introduced we produce contempt for idols and for all images, and beyond this, by raising their thinking up from serving created things instead of God, we bring them up to the Creator of all things. Setting forth openly the one who was prophesied, both from the prophecies concerning him, and these are many, and from the accounts, examined with care, handed down to those able to hear more intelligently, of the Gospels and of the apostolic voices. But as for what sorts of terrors, of every kind, we conjure up, or what fears we fabricate, as Celsus writes without any proof, let whoever wishes demonstrate it. Unless, that is, Celsus means to call, fabricated terrors, the teaching, built up with varied argument, partly from the scriptures and partly from plausible reasoning, about God as judge and about human beings being judged for everything they have done. And yet, for truth is dear, Celsus says, near the end, that neither these people nor I nor anyone else should abandon the doctrine that the unjust will be punished and the just deemed worthy of rewards. What terrors, then, do we fabricate and use to draw people in, if you take away the doctrine of punishment? But also, when he says that the misheard fragments of the ancient account, fabricating these, we pipe people up in advance and indoctrinate them beforehand, like those who buzz around people undergoing corybantic frenzy, we will say to him, misheard fragments of which ancient account? For whether it is the Greek account, which also taught about the tribunals beneath the earth, or the Jewish account, which, among other things, also prophesied about the life that follows this present one, he would not be able to show that we, having fallen into misheard fragments of the truth, at least those of us who try to believe with reason, live by such doctrines. He wants to compare the matters of our faith to the affairs of the Egyptians, among whom, for one approaching, there are splendid precincts and groves, and gateways magnificent in size and beauty, and marvelous temples, and stately pavilions all around, and rites full of superstition and mystery. But then, for one entering and going further within, one finds a cat being worshipped, or perhaps an ape, a crocodile, a goat, or else a dog. For what among us corresponds to the things that appear so solemn to those approaching the Egyptians, and what corresponds to the irrational animals worshipped within, after the solemn gateways? Or are the prophecies and the God who is over all, and the arguments against the images solemn, even by his own reckoning, while Jesus Christ crucified corresponds to the worshipped irrational animal? But if this is what he means, for I do not think he would say anything else, we will answer that more has been said above by us in support of the case concerning Jesus, that even the things which seem to have happened to him in a merely human way have proved useful for the universe as a whole and salutary for the whole world. Then, as for the Egyptians' claims, when they speak solemnly even about the irrational animals and assert that they are certain symbols of God, or however their prophets who traffic in such things prefer to name them, he says that these send forth an impression to those who have learned about them, since their initiation has not, after all, been pointless. But as for the things in our own writings that arise from what is called by Paul the gift given through the Spirit in the word of wisdom, and in, according to the Spirit, in the word of knowledge, which are presented to those well-versed in learning within Christianity, Celsus seems to me not to have formed any impression of these at all, not only from these remarks, but also from what he says next. When in accusing the Christian community, he says that they drive away every wise person from the reasoning of their faith and admit only the foolish and the slavish who are called, about which we shall learn in due course, when we come to that topic. And he says that we mock the Egyptians, even though they offer many riddles that are not trivial, when they teach that such things are honors paid to eternal forms and not, as most people suppose, to short-lived animals, and that we are foolish for introducing, in our accounts about Jesus, nothing more dignified than the goats and dogs found among the Egyptians. To this too we shall reply. Is it not so, my good man, that while you rightly praise the Egyptians for offering many riddles that are not trivial, and obscure accounts about the animals among them, you do wrong in accusing us, as though you were convinced that we say nothing worthwhile but everything without reason and cheap, when the matters concerning Jesus we set forth according to the wisdom contained in the Word, to those who are perfect, as it were, in Christianity. Concerning such people, as ones fit to hear the wisdom found in Christianity, Paul, teaching, says, we speak wisdom among the perfect, a wisdom not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away. Rather, it is God's wisdom we speak, hidden within a mystery, wisdom kept concealed, which God foreordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age has known. And we say to those who share Celsus's opinion, was it then no surpassing wisdom that Paul had in view when he promised to speak, wisdom, among the perfect? And when, in keeping with his own rashness, he claims that Paul had nothing wise in mind when he made these promises, we shall answer him in turn, saying, first clarify the letters of the man who says these things, and having fixed your gaze on the intent of each expression in them, take, for instance, the letter to the Ephesians, and to the Colossians, and to the Thessalonians, and to the Philippians, and to the Romans. Show us both things, that you have understood Paul's words, and that you can point out certain foolish or silly points in them. For if he devotes himself to reading with attention, I know well that he will either admire the man's mind, as it conceives great things in ordinary language, or, failing to admire it, he himself will appear ridiculous, whether recounting the matter as one who has understood the man's intent, or attempting to contradict and overturn what he merely imagined he had understood him to mean. And I am not yet speaking of the care shown in the Gospels regarding everything that is written, each item of which contains a meaning that is hard to discern in depth, not only for the many, but even for some of the intelligent, containing the deepest exposition of the parables which Jesus spoke to those outside, while keeping their clarity for those who have gone beyond the outward hearing and come to him privately, in the house. He will marvel, once he understands, at what reason there is for some to be called outside, while others are named as being in the house. And once more, who would not be astonished, among those able to perceive Jesus's transitions, going up a mountain for such words or deeds, or for his own transfiguration, while below he heals the sick and those unable to go up to where his disciples follow him. But to expound now the truly solemn and divine matters of the Gospels, or the Christ who is in Paul, that is, of the wisdom and of the argument, this is not the moment to consider. But even this much is sufficient against Celsus's unphilosophical mockery, when he likens the inner and mystical things of God's church to the cats, monkeys, crocodiles, goats, or dogs of the Egyptians. Leaving no form of ridicule and derision against us untried, the buffoon Celsus in his treatise against us names the Dioscuri, Heracles, Asclepius, and Dionysus, men whom the Greeks held to have risen from humanity into godhood. And he says that we cannot bear to consider these to be gods, on the ground that they were men, and men to begin with, even though they performed many noble deeds on behalf of humanity. Whereas we say that Jesus, after dying, was seen by his own followers. He further charges us with saying that he was seen, and that this too was a mere shadow. To this, we shall reply that Celsus has terribly failed either to state clearly that he himself does not revere these figures as gods, for he was wary of the opinion of those who would encounter his writing, lest they suppose him godless, if he openly professed the view he himself held to be true, or, on the other hand, to pretend that he too considers them gods, for we would have answered him differently depending on which position he took. Come then, let us say this to those who do not consider them to be gods. Do these figures not exist at all from the start, but rather, as some suppose concerning the human soul, that it perishes at once, has their soul likewise perished? Or, according to the view of those who say it persists, either as immortal or as persisting in some other way, do these persist, or are they immortal and not gods but heroes? Or perhaps not even heroes but merely souls? Suppose, then, you hold that they do not exist. In that case, we must set forth our own leading argument concerning the soul. But suppose they do exist. Even so, the doctrine of immortality must be accepted, not only from those Greeks who have spoken well concerning it, but also according to what is agreeable to the divine teachings. And we shall show that it is not possible for these figures, having become gods among many, to have come into a better place and portion after their departure from this life here, bringing with us the accounts written about them, in which is recorded much licentiousness on Heracles's part, and his womanish servitude to Omphale, and the story of Asclepius, how he was struck by his father Zeus with a thunderbolt. And we shall also speak of the Dioscuri, how at one time they live on alternate days, and at another time again they are dead, and that these, who die again and again, have been allotted honor equal to the gods. How then, by reasonable account, do they suppose that any of these should be considered a god or a hero? But as for us, when we demonstrate the things concerning our own Jesus from the prophetic writings, and after this compare the history concerning him with the histories concerning those figures, that no licentiousness at all is reported of him. For not even his own plotters, who sought false testimony against him, found even a plausible pretext for false testimony against him, by which they might accuse him on the ground of licentiousness. But even his death came about through a plot of men, and had nothing at all resembling the thunderbolt against Asclepius. And what gravity does the frenzied Dionysus possess, arrayed in a woman's attire, such that divine worship should be paid him? If those who defend these matters take refuge in allegories, one must examine separately whether the allegories are sound, and separately whether they can have any substance and be worthy of reverence and worship, beings torn to pieces by titans and cast down from the heavenly throne. But our Jesus, who appeared to his own initiates, for I will use the term found in Celsus, was seen in truth, but Celsus slanders the account by saying he was seen as a shadow. Let the stories told about those others be examined alongside the one concerning Jesus. Or does Celsus want those to be true, while these, written down by people who had seen him, and who by their very actions displayed the vividness of their perception of what they had witnessed, and made plain the disposition in which they willingly suffered for the sake of his word, are to be fictions? And who, wishing to act reasonably in everything, would arbitrarily agree with the accounts about those others, but, rushing unexamined toward the accounts about this one, disbelieve what is said about him? And again, whenever it is said about Asclepius that a great multitude of people, both Greeks and barbarians, admit that they have often seen him and still see him, not a mere apparition, but one who heals and benefits and foretells the future, Celsus asks us to believe this and does not blame those who put their faith in these things. But when we, seeing the guilelessness of the disciples and eyewitnesses of Jesus' wonders, insofar as one can perceive conscience from writings, assent to them, and to the fair-mindedness they clearly display in their own conscience, we are called simpletons by Celsus, though he himself is unable to point to, in his own phrase, an innumerable host of Greeks and barbarians who acknowledge Asclepius. For we, if he counts this a mark of dignity, are able plainly to show an innumerable host of both Greeks and barbarians acknowledging Jesus, and some display signs of having received, through this faith, something rather beyond the ordinary in the healings they perform, calling upon nothing else over those in need of healing than the God over all and the name of Jesus together with the account concerning him. Indeed, through these very things we ourselves have witnessed many people delivered from grievous afflictions, derangements, madness, and countless other conditions, which neither men nor demons had healed. But in order also to grant that some healing demon called Asclepius heals bodies, I would say to those who marvel at such a thing, or at the divination of Apollo, that if the medical treatment of bodies is a middling matter, one that falls not only to the refined, but also to the base, and if foreknowledge of the future is likewise a middling matter, for foreknowledge by no means indicates refinement in the one who foreknows, then show us how those who heal or those who foreknow are in no way base, but are proved in every way to be refined, and not far from being supposed to be gods. Yet proving that those who heal or foretell are refined is something they will be unable to do, since many reputed to be healed are unworthy of life, persons whom even a wise physician would not have wished to treat, given how improperly they live. And in the oracles of the Pythian god, you would find some commands that are not reasonable. Of these I will set out two for the present, that he ordered Cleomes, the boxer, I believe, to be honored with honors equal to a god's. I do not know what solemn thing he ever saw in his boxing, yet he honored neither Pythagoras nor Socrates with the honors of a boxer. But he also called Archilochus, a servant of the Muses, a man who displayed his poetry in the basest and most licentious subject matter and exhibited a licentious and impure character. Insofar as he was a servant of the Muses, who are supposed to be goddesses, he pronounced him a pious man. I do not know whether even an ordinary person would say that the pious man is not adorned with every moderation and virtue, or whether a decent person would say the sorts of things contained in the not-so-solemn iambics of Archilochus. But if nothing divine is evident on its own from the medical art of Asclepius and the prophetic art of Apollo, how could anyone reasonably, even granting that these things are so, worship them as gods who are in some sense pure? Especially since, through the Pythian aperture, as the so-called prophetess sits around it, the prophetic spirit enters through her female organs. Apollo, that is, the pure one, free from an earthly body. We hold nothing of the sort about Jesus and his power. For the body which came to be from the Virgin was made up of human substance, able to receive human wounds and death. Let us also look at what Celsus says after this, setting out marvels from histories that in themselves resemble things not to be believed, but that, at least as far as his own wording goes, he does not disbelieve. And first, the account concerning Aristeas of Proconnesus, about whom he says this. Then Aristeas of Proconnesus, who vanished from among men so demonically and again plainly appeared, and after a long time visited many places of the inhabited world and announced marvelous things, and whom Apollo commanded the people of Metapontum to honor as a share of the gods. This Aristeas no one any longer regards as a god. He seems to have taken the story from Pindar and Herodotus. It suffices now to set out Herodotus's own wording, taken from Book 4 of his Histories, running concerning him thus. And I have said where Aristeas, who said these things, was from, but I will tell the account concerning him that I heard at Proconnesus and Cyzicus. For they say that Aristeas, being inferior to none of the citizens in birth, went into a fuller's shop at Proconnesus and died. And the fuller, locking up his workshop, went off to tell those related to the dead man. And once word that Aristeas had perished was already circulating throughout the city, a man from Cyzicus, arriving from the city of Ardes, came to dispute with those who said this, claiming that he had met him going towards Cyzicus and had come to speech with him. And this man disputed the matter vehemently, while those related to the dead man came to the fuller's shop with what was needed, intending to carry him off. But when the room was opened, Aristeas appeared neither living nor dead. And afterward, in the 7th year, he appeared at Proconnesus and composed those verses which the Greeks now call the Arimaspia, and having composed them, he vanished a second time. This, then these cities say this. But this is what I know happened to the people of Metapontum in Italy 240 years following Aristeas's second disappearance, a conclusion I reached by comparing the accounts at Proconnesus and at Metapontum. The Metapontines say that Aristeas himself appeared to them in their country and ordered them to set up an altar of Apollo and to place a statue beside it, inscribed with the name of Aristeas of Proconnesus. For he told them that Apollo had come to their land alone among all the Italiotes, and that he himself, the one now known as Aristeas, had accompanied him. But at that time, when he was accompanying the god, he was a crow. Having said this, he vanished, and the Metapontines say that they sent to Delphi to ask the god the meaning of the man's apparition. The Pythia told them to obey the apparition, and that if they obeyed it would be better for them. They accepted this and carried it out. And now, there stands a statue bearing the name of Aristeas right beside the very image of Apollo, and around it are laurel trees. The image is set up in the marketplace. Let this much be said about Aristeas. Now, with regard to this account of Aristeas, it must be said that if Celsus had set it forth simply as a piece of history, without showing his own assent to it, as though accepting it as true, we would have answered his argument differently. But since he says that Aristeas vanished by supernatural agency and then plainly reappeared, and had visited many parts of the inhabited world and announced marvels, and moreover an oracle of Apollo commanded the Metapontines to honor Aristeas with a share of divine rank, as he sets this out on his own authority and with his own assent. This is the argument against him. How is it that, while supposing the extraordinary things written about Jesus by his disciples to be fabrications, and blaming those who believe them, you do not think these things to be either portents or fabrications? And how is it that, while accusing others of believing without reason the extraordinary things about Jesus, you yourself show that you have believed so many things, bringing no proof or demonstration whatsoever that they actually happened? Or is it that Herodotus and Pindar are, in your judgment, considered free of falsehood, while those who practiced dying for the teachings of Jesus, and who left to those who followed them writings about the things of which they had been persuaded, things that are, as you suppose, about fabrications and myths and portents, struggle so hard for them that they even live under persecution and die violently for their sake? Set yourself, then, in the middle between what has been written about Aristeas and what is recorded about Jesus, and see whether one may not say, from the outcome and from the benefit gained toward the correction of character and toward reverence for the God overall, that what is recorded about Jesus must be believed as not having come about apart from God, while what is recorded about Aristeas of Proconnesus must not. For what did Providence intend in bringing about the marvels concerning Aristeas, and what benefit did it intend for the human race in displaying, as you suppose, things of such magnitude? You cannot say. But we, when we recount the things concerning Jesus, do not offer just any ordinary defense for their having happened, namely that God willed to establish, through Jesus, a way as the saving message for human beings, confirmed by the apostles as by foundations of the building of Christianity now being laid, and continuing to grow in the times that followed, in which not a few healings performed in Jesus' name, along with certain other epiphanies not to be despised, are still being accomplished. But what sort of thing is this Apollo, who charges the people of Metapontum to number Aristeas among the gods? And to what end does he do this, and what benefit is he arranging to come to the Metapontines from the honor paid to him as to a god, if they should now reckon as a god a man who a little before was merely human? But if the pronouncements concerning Aristeas, from Apollo, that spirit of ours who has obtained as his prize libation and burnt fat savor, seem to you worth taking seriously, while those concerning the God over all and his holy angels, delivered through the prophets, not after Jesus had come to be, but foretold before he sojourned among the life of human beings, do not move you to marvel, neither at the prophets who received the divine spirit nor at the one prophesied by them. His sojourn into human life happened to be proclaimed many years beforehand, through so many voices that the whole Jewish nation, hanging upon the expectation of the one hoped for, who was to come, fell into disputing among themselves once Jesus had come. And a great multitude of them confessed Christ and came to believe that he was the one prophesied, while those who did not believe, scorning the gentleness of those who, because of Jesus' teachings, were unwilling to rebel even to the smallest degree, dared such things against Jesus as his disciples, in love of truth and fair-mindedness, recorded, not concealing, from the paradoxical account concerning him, whatever seemed to most people to bring shame upon the word of the Christians. For Jesus himself wished, and so did his disciples, that those who came to him should believe not only in his divinity and his paradoxical deeds, as though he had not shared in human nature nor taken up the flesh that exists among human beings, which desires against the spirit, but rather they saw that the power descending into human nature and into human circumstances, and taking up a human soul and a human body, was, through being believed in together with the more divine elements, contributing to the salvation of those who believe, seeing that from that point on the divine and the human nature began to be woven together, so that the human, through communion with what is more divine, might become divine, not in Jesus alone, but also in all those who, along with believing, take up the life that Jesus taught, which leads up to friendship with God and to communion with him, for everyone whose life follows the precepts Jesus set down. Now the Apollo of Celsus wishes the people of Metapontum to number Aristeas among the gods. But since the Metapontines, having in view the manifest reality of Aristeas as a man, and perhaps not even a worthy one, considered it stronger evidence than the oracle concerning him, that he counted as a god or merited divine honors, and for this reason were unwilling to be persuaded by Apollo, and so no one thinks Aristeas a god. But concerning Jesus we would say that, since it was beneficial to the human race to receive him as the Son of God, God who had come in a human soul and body, and this did not seem advantageous to the gluttony of the body-loving demons and of those who consider them to be gods. For this reason the demons on earth, regarded as gods by those uneducated about demons, opposed the teaching. But those who worship them also wished to hinder the spread of Jesus's teaching, for they saw the libations and the savory smoke of sacrifice, in which they took gluttonous delight, being diminished as the teachings of Jesus gained mastery. But the God who sent Jesus, having dissolved every plot of the demons, brought it about that throughout the whole inhabited world, for the conversion and correction of humanity, the gospel of Jesus should prevail, and that everywhere there should arise churches set in opposition to the assemblies of the superstitious, the licentious, and the unjust. For such are the people who everywhere make up the citizenry of the masses of the cities. But the churches of God that have been made disciples of Christ, when compared with the assemblies of the peoples among whom they dwell, are as lights in the world. For who could deny that even the worst members of the church, those who fall far short by comparison with the better, are nevertheless far superior to the assemblies found among the peoples? For the church of God, let us say, at Athens is a gentle and stable one, since it wishes to please the god who is over all. But the assembly of the Athenians is factious and in no way comparable to the Church of God there. You could say the same about the Church of God in Corinth and the assembly of the people of Corinth, and, let us say, about the Church of God in Alexandria and the assembly of the people of Alexandria. And if the one who hears this is fair-minded and examines the matter with a love of truth, he will marvel at the one who both planned and was able to accomplish the founding, everywhere, of churches of God, dwelling alongside the assemblies of the peoples in each city. And likewise, setting the council of God's church side by side with the council belonging to each city, you would discover which of the church's counselors are truly worthy, if any such there be anywhere in the whole world a city of God, to be citizens there. Whereas the counselors found everywhere bear nothing in their own characters worthy of the superiority their rank seems to give them over the other citizens. And in like manner, one ought to set the ruler of each city's church alongside the ruler of that same city's other inhabitants, so that you may perceive that even among the most disappointing counselors and rulers of the Church of God and those who live more carelessly than those who live more vigorously, one can nonetheless find, no less, a general superiority in progress toward the virtues over the characters of those who serve as counselors and rulers in the cities. And if this is so, how is it not reasonable to hold, concerning Jesus, who is able to accomplish so much, that no ordinary divinity was in him, no longer in Aristeas of Proconnesus either, even if Apollo wishes to assign him a place among the gods, nor in those figures Celsus lists when he says that no one considers Abaris the Hyperborean a god, though he possessed such power as to travel borne along on an arrow. For what did the divinity that granted this to Abaris the Hyperborean intend in bestowing on him so great a gift, being borne along on an arrow, except that he might derive some benefit, the race of mankind? Or what benefit did that man himself gain from being struck by an arrow? Even granting that these things are in no way fictions, but came about through some cooperation of a divine power. But if my Jesus is said to be taken up in glory, I see the design in this, that the God who brought this about commended the teacher to those who witnessed it, so that, as contending not for human teachings but for divine teaching, they might devote themselves, insofar as their power allowed, to God who reigns over all things, and do everything for the sake of pleasing him, since they will receive, according to their merit, in the divine tribunal, whatever they have done well or badly in this life. Since after this Celsus also spoke about the man of Clazomene, adding, following his own account of him, do they not say this, that his soul often left his body and wandered about incorporeal, and yet men did not consider even him a god? And to this, we shall say that perhaps certain wicked demons contrived to have such things recorded, for I do not think it was they who brought about the events themselves. So that the things prophesied concerning Jesus and the things said by him might either be discredited as fictions similar to those, or as having nothing more than others, not be greatly admired. Now my Jesus spoke concerning his own soul, not as parting from the body by human necessity, but according to the extraordinary authority given to him in this matter as well, these words: it is not another who removes my soul from me, rather I myself set it down of my own will. I have authority to lay it down, and again I have authority to take it up. For since he had authority to lay it down, he laid it down when he said, Father, why have you forsaken me? And having cried out with a loud voice, he gave up his spirit, getting ahead of the executioners in charge of those impaled on the stake, who cut the legs of the crucified, and cut them for this reason, so that they might not suffer punishment any longer. And he took up his soul again when he showed himself to the disciples, having foretold this beforehand to the Jews who disbelieved him. Destroy this temple, and within 3 days I will have it raised up again. And he said this about the temple of his body. And the prophets had proclaimed this very thing in advance through many passages, and also through this one. Moreover, my flesh also will dwell in hope, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Celsus showed that he had read a great many Greek histories, citing also the story of Cleomenes of Aestypalia, whom he recounted as having descended into a chest, and, though caught inside it, was not found within, but had flown out beyond by some demonic dispensation, when certain people broke open the chest in order to seize him. And this, if it is a fiction, as it does seem to be a fiction, is not comparable to what concerns Jesus, since in that man's case no token whatever of the reported divinity is found in the life of men, whereas in the case of Jesus, there are the churches of those who have benefited, the prophecies spoken concerning him, the healings performed in his name, the knowledge accompanied by wisdom that comes through him. And this is a rationale found among those who have taken care to rise above bare faith and to search out the meaning in the divine scriptures, following the counsel Jesus gave when he said, "Search the scriptures." It likewise follows what Paul intended in teaching that each of us must know the proper way to give an answer to every person, but also of him who said, "Always ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you an account concerning the faith that is in you." But if he himself wishes it to be conceded that it is not a fabrication, let him say it. What purpose did the power beyond man have in making him fly out of the chest by some demonic fate? For if he can present something noteworthy, and a will of God worthy of having granted such a thing to Cleomenes, we shall judge what must be said to him. But if he will be at a loss even to say something plausible on the matter, then clearly, to the extent that no rational account is found, we shall either join those who do not accept the story and charge it with being untrue, or we shall say that some demon, similar to those who by sorcery display deceptions of the eyes, did this also in the case of the man of Astypalea, about whom Celsus thinks he uttered some divine oracle, that he flew off from the chest by some demonic fate. Now I for my part think that Celsus knew only these examples, and so that he might seem to be deliberately passing over similar ones, he said, "One could mention many other such cases." Well then, let it be granted and conceded that many more such cases occurred, which brought no benefit to the human race. What would each of these be found to amount to, compared with the work of Jesus and the wonders concerning him, about which we have spoken at greater length? After this, he thinks that we, who worship one who, as Celsus says, was captured and died, have done something similar to the Getae, who revere Zamalxis, the Cilicians, who revere Mopsus, the Acarnanians, who revere Amphilochus, the Thebans, who revere Amphiaraus, and the Lebadians, who revere Trophonius. And on these points, too, we shall refute him for not reasonably comparing us to those just mentioned. For those people built temples and statues for the figures they listed, whereas we, having stripped away honor of that kind from the divine, as being more fitting for demons, which have somehow settled in a given place, a place they either seize beforehand, or, drawn by certain rites and sorceries, come to inhabit as if it were their home, we stand in awe of Jesus, who has turned our mind away from everything perceptible to the senses, as being not only corruptible but destined for destruction, and who leads us, together with an upright life, up to the honor of the God over all, with prayers that we offer to him as one who stands between the nature of the unbegotten and the nature of all begotten things, who both brings us the benefits that come from the Father and conveys, in the manner of a high priest, our prayers to the God over all. I should like to engage, in a manner fitting to him, in some such idle chatter with the man who says such things, I do not know how he says them, and ask, "Are these, then, whom you have listed, nothing at all? Is there no power at Lebadea connected with Trophonius, nor at Thebes around the temple of Amphiaraus, nor in Acarnania around Amphilochus, nor in Cilicia around Mopsus? Or is there among such figures either a demon, or a hero, or even a god, accomplishing something greater than is possible for a human being? For if he says that there is nothing else, neither demonic nor divine, connected with these figures, let him now at least confess his own opinion. Since he is an Epicurean, and does not think the same things as the Greeks, and neither acknowledges demons nor even worships gods as the Greeks do, then let him be refuted for having pointlessly brought forward, as though accepting them as true, both what he said before and what he adduces in what follows. But if he says that those he has listed are either demons or heroes or even gods, let him see that by what he has said, he will establish the very thing he does not want. Namely, that Jesus too was something of this kind, and that this is why he has been able to present himself to no small number of people as having come down from God to the human race. But once he grants this, consider whether he will be compelled to admit that this being is stronger than those he has counted him among. For none of those others prevents the honors paid to different gods, whereas this one, confident in himself as more powerful than all of them, forbids the acceptance of honors paid to those others, as being wicked demons who have seized beforehand places upon the earth, since they cannot lay hold of the purer and more divine region, where the coarsenesses that come from the earth and its countless evils do not reach. And since after this, he also brings up the matter of Hadrian's favorite, I mean the affair of the youth Antinous and the honors paid to him by the people of Antinoopolis in Egypt, thinking that it falls short in nothing of the honor we pay to Jesus, come, let us refute this too, spoken as it is out of sheer hostility. For what has the life lived among Hadrian's favorites in common? A man who did not even keep his manhood free from a woman's disease, with our revered Jesus, whom not even those who have leveled countless accusations against him, saying whatever falsehoods they please about him, have been able to charge with even the slightest taste of licentiousness, however small. But indeed, if one examined the matter of Antinous with love of truth and without partiality, one would find that the causes of his seeming to do something in Antinoopolis even after his death were Egyptian trickeries and rites, a thing which is also recorded to have happened by Egyptians and by others skilled in such matters, in connection with other temples, in certain places, where they establish demons of divination or of healing, and often also torment those who seem to have transgressed in some way regarding ordinary foods or regarding the touching of a human corpse, so that they may seem to terrify the common, uneducated crowd. Such is also the one who has been reckoned a god in Antinoopolis of Egypt, whose virtues some, living rather like gamblers, falsely claim, while others are deceived by the demon established there. And yet others, convicted by a weak conscience, suppose they are paying a penalty driven by God on account of Antinous. Such too are the mysteries performed for him, and the seeming oracles, from which the things concerning Jesus are very far removed. For it was not that sorcerers came together to do a favor for some king who commanded it, or governor who ordered it, and so made him seem to be a god, but the creator of all things himself, in keeping with the persuasive power that is wondrously effective in his speaking, established him as worthy of honor, not only to those human beings who are willing to think rightly, but also to demons and other invisible powers, who to this very day show either that they fear the name of Jesus as something greater than themselves, or that they accept it reverently as the name of one who rules according to their own laws. For if it were not a constitution given to him from God, demons too would not, simply by yielding to his name when it is pronounced, withdraw from those whom they are attacking. Since the Egyptians were taught to worship Antinous, they will tolerate a comparison of Apollo or Zeus to him, for they glorify Antinous precisely by counting him among those gods. And here too Celsus is plainly lying when he says, even if you compare to him Apollo or Zeus, they will not tolerate it. But Christians have learned that eternal life for them consists in knowing the only true God over all and him whom that God sent, Jesus Christ. And they have also learned that every god among the nations is but a demon, greedy for sacrifices and blood, and for the portions carried off from the sacrifices, wallowing in these things to deceive those who have not fled for refuge to the God over all things. While God's angels, holy and divine, differ in nature and purpose from every demon on earth, and are known to very few, only to those who have searched into such matters with intelligence and care. So that if you were to compare Apollo and Zeus, or any of those worshipped with the smoke of fat and blood and sacrifices, to him, such people will not tolerate it, some because of their great simplicity, not knowing how to give an account of what they do, yet faithfully keeping what they have received. Others with arguments that are not to be despised, but are in fact quite profound, and, as a Greek might put it, esoteric and belonging to the higher mysteries, in which there is much discussion of God and of those who have been honored by God through the only begotten God, the Word, by participation in deity, and for this reason honored in name as well. And there is much discussion too about the divine angels, and about those who stand against the truth yet have themselves been deceived, and who, led by that deception, proclaim themselves gods, or messengers of God, or benevolent demons, or heroes arising from the transformation of a virtuous human soul. Such beings are Christians in truth, just as many in philosophy suppose themselves to be so in truth, having either beguiled themselves with persuasive arguments or having rashly assented to arguments put forward and devised by others. So too there are, among the souls that exist apart from bodies, and among angels and demons, some who, drawn by such persuasive appearances, have proclaimed themselves gods. And because of such arguments, which cannot be found among human beings in a wholly exact and precise form, it was judged safe to entrust oneself, being human, to no one as to a god, except to the one alone who presides over all as arbiter, Jesus Christ, who both contemplated these things most profoundly and handed them down to a few. Concerning Antinous, then, or anyone else of that kind, whether among the Egyptians or among the Greeks, there is belief, so to call her, unlucky. But concerning Jesus, she would either seem to be lucky, or she has been examined with rigorous scrutiny, seeming lucky to the many, but examined with rigorous scrutiny by a very small few indeed. And even if I grant that there is a kind of faith which the many would call lucky, I refer the account of it back to the God who knows the causes of the things apportioned to each person during his sojourn in life. The Greeks too will say, even among those reputed wisest, that in many respects good luck is the cause, for instance, in the matter of one's teachers and of encountering the better sort, since there are also those who teach the opposite schools of thought, and in the matter of an upbringing among better people. For many have had their upbringing amid such circumstances that they were not even allowed to catch a glimpse of the better things, but were always, from their earliest years, either among licentious men as children, or under licentious masters, or hemmed in by some other misfortune that kept the soul from looking upward.